From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not every writer who looks up at the big screen to see a depraved and drugged version of herself played by Meryl Streep. But Susan Orlean has, and she's taken it, she says, in stride. A best-selling author and staff writer for The New Yorker, Susan Orlean has made a great career in intimate portraits of people. Sometimes celebrated people, but more often the eccentric, the unheralded, the marvelously obsessed. She has famously brought us The Orchid Thief of her book by the same name, wildly adapted for the movie adaptation. Her New Yorker portrait of Maui's surfer chicks became Hollywood's Blue Crush. Her profile of a New York City clown took on an unsettling dimension years later with the family revelations of Andrew Jarecki's film, Capturing the Freedmans. Susan Orlean has an ear for dialogue, an eye for detail, and an instinct for character. She's also learned the limits of the portraitist's craft. Tonight on Point, a conversation with Susan Orlean. Joining me now in the studio is Susan Orlean, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. She's author of The Orchid Thief, a true story of beauty and obsession, The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, My Encounters with Extraordinary People, and Saturday Night. She also typed Throw Me a Bone, 50 Healthy Canine Taste-Tested Recipes for Snacks, Meals, and Treats for her dog, Cooper Gillespie. Good evening and welcome, Susan Orlean.
Very happy to be here.
It's terrific. It's just terrific to have you. We've been reading you for so many years and with so much pleasure, and then seeing how work after work ends up on the big screen, so we get all of that funny interplay to think about as well. Here you are, kind of the, 40-something, we'll say, top of your career, all kinds of interest from every angle in what you've written and presumably what you'll write down the road. How do you decide what to focus on these days, Susan Orlean? How do you decide what to write about when the whole world really is open to you, if you can write about the range of things you have?
You know, I try to find the same feeling that I've had in all the pieces that I've done all along. And it's a real authentic desire for, I'm writing it for myself in a way. When I fall onto an idea that just gets me excited, that I'm sort of bubbling over, I can't wait to get my hands on it. I feel like I've hit the right stride. And there are times when I think, boy, I'm never going to come up with another story as good as The Orchid Thief or as good as, you know, there so often I'll do a piece and think, oh, this is just the best. How could I ever come up with a subject that is as exciting or as engaging or surprising? And then, lo and behold, it'll happen. The world is, I'm happy to say that if you're a curious person, there's no limit to what's out there to write about. And narrowing myself is the challenge. I feel like that's what's harder.
In your case, we can see that many of our listeners will have read a lot of what you've written or seen film adaptations of it. But apart from the things that we mentioned, Orchid Thief and so on, give us a sense of the sort of range of people that you've written about. Beyond the surfer chicks, beyond the Orchid Thief, take us on down
right
to the spectrum of Susan Orlean subjects.
When I look at my collection, Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, and which begins with the profile of a 10-year-old boy who is just a suburban kid in New Jersey who I wanted to try to evoke the feeling of what it's like to be a typical 10-year-old boy. I profiled a New York City real estate broker, which was incredibly fun, I have to say. I mean, it was like being a peeping Tom, going in and out of apartments day and night, seeing how people live. I went to a taxidermy convention a couple of months ago. I'm just sort of showing you the variety of highs and lows. I was looking at a $30 million apartment as part of the story with the real estate broker, and then just a few months later was at a taxidermy convention.
Where they're stuffing wild animals
absolutely.
And talking about tricks of the trade.
Yeah, exactly. How do you really craft a really perfect nostril on a deer? And I thought, this is what's so great about what I get to do, and that is something will stick in my mind, and I think, gee, I wonder what that's like. I wonder what that's about. Or I wonder why people care about that.
There's a Zen question for you, how to craft a perfect nostril.
Boy, I'm still trying to figure it out. So,
Susan Orlean, we are going to work you pretty hard tonight because
All right.
we want to hear your work in your own voice. And I guess the work that is probably best known, read by the most people, but also endlessly fascinating, is The Orchid Thief. Of course, this is the famous tale of your obsessed orchid hunter who goes illegally into the swamps of Florida to find the perfect ghost orchid. If you've seen the movie adaptation, it is not in the book as it is in the movie, and we'll talk about that. There's some pretty wild divergence at a certain point. But let us get a feeling for this. Bring something to us. What can you read us from The Orchid
Thief? Well, I'm going to read from fairly early on in the book when I was trying to figure out exactly why I was working on the book and also what the nature of this obsession with this particular flower was, which, of course, kind of ended up capturing my own curiosity. So this is from early on in the book. If the ghost orchid was really only a phantom, it was still such a bewitching one that it could seduce people to pursue it year after year and mile after miserable mile. If it was a real flower, I wanted to keep coming back to Florida until I could see one. The reason was not that I love orchids. I don't even especially like orchids. What I wanted was to see this thing that people were drawn to in such a singular and powerful way. Everyone I was meeting connected to the orchid poaching had circled their lives around some great desire, a desire that then answered questions for them about how to spend their time and their money and who their friends would be and where they would travel and what they did when they got there. It was religion. I wanted to want something as much as people wanted these plants, but it isn't part of my constitution. I think people my age are embarrassed by too much enthusiasm and believe that too much passion about anything is naive. I suppose I do have one unembarrassing passion. I want to know what it feels like to care about something passionately. That night I called LaRoche and told him that I had just come back from looking for ghost orchids in the Fakahatchee, but that I had seen nothing but bare roots. I said that I was wondering whether I had missed this year's flowers, or whether perhaps the only place the ghost orchid bloomed was in the imagination of people who'd walked too long in the swamp. What I didn't say was that strong feelings always make me skeptical at first. What else I didn't say was that his life seemed to be filled with things that were just like the ghost orchid, wonderful to imagine and easy to fall in love with, but a little fantastic and fleeting and out of reach.
Susan Orlean reading from The Orchid Thief, and of course you mentioned in there talking about calling LaRoche, and this was John LaRoche, he of the great passion for the orchid. You describe in the first lines of the New Yorker piece as a tall guy, skinny as a stick, pale-eyed, slouch-shouldered, and sharply handsome, in spite of the fact that he is missing all his front teeth.
Right. It was sort of a characteristic quality of his, which the first time I saw him after a couple of years was at the screening of Adaptation, and he had actually gotten false teeth. And it was so shocking because it was such a strong
statement
of who he was, which is this in your face, this is who I am, take it or leave it. And he was pretty raggedy at the time that I met him, and that added to his raggedy appearance.
Now, we know from the movie, or think we know, that you went on to have an affair with John LaRoche, that you had a drugged debauch with John LaRoche, a shootout with John LaRoche in the swamp. Not true, though.
Well, the shootout, of course.
Yes. No.
Yes, the departure begins fairly early on in the movie. The idea of being involved with a subject in a romantic way, and particularly John LaRoche, who, frankly, I was readier to kill him than to have an affair with him. But that was all part of the wild imagination of the screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, who drew his, or I should say extrapolated from his own struggle with how to resolve the way to write this into a movie by turning the book and my experience of writing the book into another sort of fever.
Let's just hear a little clip from that, the 2002 movie Adaptation, directed by Spike Jonze. And here, Susan Orlean, who's sitting with me now, is played by Meryl Streep then. She's being interviewed by Donald Kaufman, the fictional screenwriter played by Nicolas Cage, in her offices in The New Yorker.
So, I guess I'll bring out the big guns now. Do you keep in touch with LaRoche? The reason I ask is that I felt I detected an attraction to him in the subtext. Care to comment?
Well, our relationship was strictly reporter-subject. I mean, certainly an intimacy does evolve in this kind of relationship. By definition, I was so interested in everything he had to say. But the relationship ends when the book ends.
Meryl Streep playing Susan Orlean, sort of, in the movie adaptation of The Orchid Thief, called Adaptation. Susan Orlean, here's this dynamic where a screenwriter takes a book or a story and runs with it, and it's not what happened in life. But every time you sit down or spend a day or a week or weeks with some subject, you are also, in some sense, creating an adaptation of their life. I mean, you know what's going on, and yet you don't know what's going on. You're creating a fiction out of nonfiction. How actively do you feel that?
I actively feel it, and I actively think about it as one of the great ethical issues in being a writer and being a nonfiction writer. I can be factual, and I can be emotionally truthful when I'm writing, but the fact is there is a filter. I mean, there's another person who I'm writing about and describing, and I can't get at an absolute truth. In fact, I was asked this morning if I felt that it was appropriate for a writer to assume, a journalist, to assume that they could portray people's inner thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
People do it. I absolutely don't do it. I think it's a leap that's unsupportable. I mean, you don't know people's inner thoughts. What you know, I think the best thing you can do to present as truthful a version of your story as you can is to acknowledge how subjective it is and how limited it is, and let the reader appreciate those limits, and within that they can read the story and know this is my version of what I saw, and I'm telling it to you as honestly as I can, but I can't pretend that it's absolutely the truth. That's a silly notion.
As honestly as you can, and yet even within that, from the first second that you meet this person, or even before you've met a subject, when you've heard something about them, you've begun to read, you've seen a clip in the newspaper, whatever's turned you onto them, you must already be thinking about how you're going to craft a piece, something that's going to run in New York or that might become the nub of a book. I mean, you're already imagining the architecture of a narrative flow, of a compelling characterization.
You are writing. I mean, you're in the experience, you're spending time with people, but you're also operating at another level, which is registering, that's a good scene for the story, or boy, that makes it a better book.
But at that level, are you a kind of orchid thief? I mean, there's this notion that whenever a journalist sits and talks with someone, that person is being stripped of something or being actively miscast, because the journalist can't, or the writer in your case, cannot know exactly what's really going on.
Janet Malcolm wrote a piece that was very controversial some years ago, basically saying that no matter what, the journalist is using their subject. It's not always in a negative way, but it is an exchange. You are taking something out of people's lives, crafting it, creating something. It's not an evil process, but it is a process. It's funny. A friend of mine who used to write about Haiti a lot was going to go to a church for some occasion and ended up not going. And a photographer she knew was there, and the church was bombed and people were killed. It was a horrible experience. And the friend of mine was really jealous that she wasn't there and this photographer we knew was there, because that's the business we're in. You like the more dramatic things to unfold in front of you because it's better material. It doesn't mean you're a bad person, but you are looking for your own ghost orchid. You know, as a writer, you've got to be really passionate about getting this beautiful thing, this story.
Deep in the swamp of one person's character, even.
Exactly.
Susan Orlean, stand by. We have to take a short break. I'm talking tonight with the New Yorker magazine writer, Susan Orlean. We'll be right back.
And you comb your hair, shave your face, trying to wipe out every trace of all the other days. In a week, you know that this will be the Saturday you reach.
reaching your peak, stopping on a red.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Susan Orlean, staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and author of The Orchid Thief and The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, among many other books and wonderful portraits in the New Yorker. We're working Susan Orlean pretty hard tonight, getting her to read for us. And I want to ask you to read something more. But before you do, tell us a little bit about your own story. You've been writing with the New Yorker for a number of years now, but you grew up in Ohio.
Right.
What kind of family, what kind of town? Give us a sense of what eye you're bringing to these stories, from Maui surfer girls to orchid thieves in the Fakahatchee Swamp.
I grew up in a suburb of Cleveland.
Shaker Heights. Nice suburb.
Lovely suburb that also has... I think this is an important point. It's got a reputation as being a very beautiful place, which it is. Mm-hmm. It's also one of the first and only voluntarily integrated affluent suburbs in the country. So I grew up, even though it would have the appearance of being the classic upper middle class suburb, it was a very interesting place, a lot more diverse than you would expect. My father's a real estate developer.
And in Ohio, a state that still has some trouble with race relations.
Oh,
we
absolutely.
Watched Cincinnati in recent years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was a very progressive, very interesting place to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
My father's a real estate developer. And when I was a kid, this point in Cleveland's history, everybody had fled to the suburbs and nobody even went into the city. And my father would load us into the car, drive us downtown, drive us through sections of the city where there had been riots to say, I want you to see how other people live. Mm-hmm. Not everybody lives in Shaker
mm-hmm.
Heights.
Mm-hmm.
To me, when I look back on how I ended up doing what I do, that is one of the clues.
Those glimpses, your father cracking open the door, saying, look at this.
And saying, you should see the world for what it is and look beyond yourself. I mean, what you've got is great, but there are other ways that people live, and it's important to know what those ways are.
You knew you wanted to be a writer from very early on and not a journalist.
I always wanted to tell stories. I always wanted to tell the stories the most seductively and the most persuasively I could, but I never cared about being first. I never cared about knowing things before other people
mm-hmm.
knew them. I have always had this instinct, a little bit of a missionary zeal to say, listen to me, let me tell you the story you don't think you care about.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about a guy, a toothless kook in Florida who you think may have no impact in your life, but just stay with me. Let me tell you the story. So it's a different impulse, I think, from a journalist who is committed to knowing things first and coming from the inside of a story. I'm happy to say I'm the outsider who's going to be drawn into a new world, and then I'm going to come back out and say to readers, let me tell you about a world that I learned about.
There was a piece in the New Yorker of yours a couple of years ago where you turned the lens around on yourself a bit. And I wish you'd read it for us. It's called Shadow Memory, and we'll see how it leads you to some insights on knowing and on knowing where we stand in chains of events, chains of lives, perhaps even. Could you read Shadow Memory for us?
Certainly. When my grandmother died a few years ago, I was given her formal china, her silverware, a fur-lined lap robe, and her Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, second edition, an old brick of a book, leather-bound, with skin-thin pages and black half-moon thumb tabs. I was more taken with the china and the silverware than the Webster's. After all, I had much newer dictionaries, as well as a computer that could spell and find synonyms on its own. One afternoon in the throes of spring cleaning, I decided to get rid of it. Before pitching it into my rummage box, I idly riffled through its pages. I flipped past the color plates showing house flags of steamship lines and the multi-column table of oils and fats and the pen and ink drawings of diploids and seed weevils and page after page of ant-sized type defining grossorial and sacrarium and tingle, until I came upon a page, Luna cornea through Lusless, that was stuck lightly to the next. I peeled the pages apart. Between them was a small four-leaf clover, all of its leaves facing upward, its long stem curving into a lazy J. The clover was still green, or at least greenish, and the leaves were dry and perfectly flat, but hardy and well attached to the stem. A little stain of clover juice was printed onto the pages it had been pressed between. It was startling to come across these two lives pressed between pages, my grandmother's and this weed which she must have found when? When she was out for a walk? At a picnic? Had my grandfather found the clover and saved it for her? Or had some other suitor offered it to her, hoping for his own luck? Had my grandmother tucked it into her dictionary and then forgotten it? Did she pick this page for a purpose? Or did she just place it somewhere in the middle of the book and fail to note the page, so that when she went back for it weeks or years later, she couldn't find it and never saw it again? Not since my grandmother died had I had such a distinct sense of her, a sense of her as I'd never actually known her, as a young woman with the time and patience to sort through blades of grass looking for four leaves on a clover, believing in the luck one might bring her. And I believed I was lucky, too, having been so close to losing it, to discarding it, to never knowing what I had in my hands. So this is what's left behind, these things that end up as our real inheritance, the flotsam and jetsam of life, the stuff that drifts into our hands and into history, the chance impression, the little shadow each of us casts, the fragile thing someone carefully catalogs and cares for, and then forgets, or maybe doesn't, the image of an image that conjures a memory that is either real or imagined. These are here, plucked and pressed between the pages, so they will stay fresh forever, or forever slip away.
Susan Orlean reading Shadow Memory from the New Yorker. Now, I was struck, as I read this, by how it may turn out that what that clover was for you, your portraits of real people may be for their grandchildren, may fall out, you know, from between pages of their yearbook, be the thing that they read. How heavy is the weight that you carry thinking about that? How real the connection to these people that you at some level turn into literature or even entertainment, yet this is a characterization. People don't often get characterized in the way that you do, ordinary people in the course of a life.
It's a big investment. It's a big, I think burden is maybe too negative a term. It's a big responsibility. I profiled this 10-year-old boy who I mentioned earlier. His mother called me when my collection came out and the story was being reprinted. And she said, I wanted to catch you up on what Colin's doing. In my mind, he's 10 years old. He always will
right,
be.
Right.
And in the minds, I think, of all the readers who've read that story, and it's been reprinted many, many times, mm-hmm. he's forever sort of captured at 10. So when his mother said to me, he's a senior in college, I almost fell
impossible.
Over. I thought, this isn't possible. Because that there is a way that writing captures and freeze frames things. There's something very poignant about it. I think in the sense as, for instance, I profiled Bill Blass a few years ago, and he's one of the few famous people I've written about who I just adored him. He passed away a little bit after the mm-hmm. piece was published. It meant a great deal to me to have, I haven't had that experience that much of having someone die who I've written about. And going back to that piece and reading it, to me, it was very vivid.
Because you had captured him, because your characterization of him would stay on.
And in a way, it's different from a photograph because there's a much more interpretive element of it. And I know a lot of people who knew him well said, and he had said, that he felt that the piece, even though it's just a sort of slice of life piece about him, he felt really understood. That's a big responsibility. It's a wonderful one but it's a big one.
It's a responsibility, it's an accomplishment,
It's also a trick that you do in a way without a net. And I know, you know, it doesn't always work perfectly. It doesn't always work all the way to bone, to ground. You famously had the story in the mid-90s of David Friedman, a New York City clown that you profiled, who then some years later, again famously, was the subject with his family of this documentary by Andrew Jarecki, Capturing the Friedmans, where it turns out, unmentioned and unknown in your article, that his father was a pederast and that this had been a large influential factor in his life. What did you ultimately take away from that, having seen yourself profile a guy where the central piece of his larger family life was missing from the profile that you did, which was so satisfying in its own terms, but without that slice of pie?
Right. I mean, that was a very big soul-searching moment for me. When I did the piece about David, my interest at that time was I loved thinking of people with jobs that struck me as very unique jobs. And the idea of being a children's clown seemed like what a great job to write about. I asked him about his family. He was somewhat evasive. And I didn't pursue it because the fact is it wasn't really that important to that story, which was to capture the day-to-day life, the grind of making balloon animals for Manhattan kiddies, day in and day out.
But did it lead you to a kind of career crisis like, oh, my God, I've gone out and written all about the grind of making balloon animals and not seen or been able to see or been shown, in this case, this huge continent of trouble and woe and even tragedy that was sitting next to it?
It was a moment where I go back to what I said earlier, which is I am very comfortable acknowledging the subjectivity, the limits mm-hmm. of what I do and how I do it. What would I have done if I had come upon this information about David's family? The story would have been a different story.
Yeah.
It would have been
the premise would have been
it would have
kaput
been completely a different story. Mm-hmm. It would have suddenly been this is a story about a family that caved in and fell apart. Mm. I would have not made such a big fuss about him being a children's clown. I mean, that would have been the way I would have pursued it. Normally, when I'm writing about someone, their parents aren't particularly important in the story. In this case, I said, "What did your family do?" He said, "My father passed away. He was a teacher. That was it."
How do you feel about it? Here's what I do. And I got David Friedman in my lens, and I did what I do with David Friedman. Or is it, I should have gone on a deeper safari to find out every dimension. You can't, when you're doing a portrait, there are bounds to it. There's a frame around it, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, and the framework in that case, I mean, not to defend myself, because it's an important question.
It is.
In this case, the framework was pretty explicitly, this is a guy with a funny job, and the day-to-day life, to me, what was almost more interesting was it was a way of looking at the children of Manhattan through the conduit of this crazy profession, which is to entertain kids at these fancy birthday parties. It was funny because David Friedman said to me, we had lunch recently, and he said to me that Andrew Jarecki said to him a few times in the course of the film, boy, I bet that Susan Orlean is kicking herself. And I said, be sure to tell Andrew Jarecki that I'm not kicking myself. I think he did a brilliant job. The movie's amazing. I don't feel competitive with it. I was doing a different story. Did I miss something big? I don't know that I missed it as much as I wasn't. I wasn't going down that path. I feel very content with the portrait that I created, which didn't present itself as this is the A to Z version of David Friedman.
And at the same time, it must be a good moment for humility and to remember the limits omniscience is given to none of us.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm struck, Susan, again and again, the subjects that you touch on. They're beautifully written, but they they're wonderfully perceptive at so many levels. They also end up being in films and blown up into books. And there's something in what you look for that works. There's something that's often the substance of a very popular...
Isn't that funny? Because I write about such odd things. I mean,
Hollywood doesn't follow around every portraitist looking for the next film.
I know. I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. I'm tickled by it. I also think I find it very funny because I think I have such eccentric tastes. I have such unconventional interests.
And yet you see what's seductive. You see what's attractive. I wish you'd read a little bit for us from your piece on Maui Surfer Girls, which inspired the movie Blue Crush.
Certainly. And I'm just going to this is a section about Teresa McGregor, who is one of the surf girls, and her mom, Angie McGregor. I went down to Coquille. Angie McGregor was indeed there, and she pointed out Teresa bobbing in the swells. There were about a dozen other people in the water, kids mostly. A few other surfer parents were up on the grass with Angie, fathers with hairy chests and ponytails and saddle leather sandals, and mothers wearing board shorts and bikini tops, passing around snacks of unpeeled carrots and whole wheat cookies and sour cream Pringles. And even as they spoke to one another, they had their eyes fixed on the ocean watching their kids, who seemed like they were 1,000 miles away, taking quick rides on the tattered waves. After a few minutes, Teresa appeared up on dry land. She was a big, broad-shouldered girl, 16 years old, fierce-faced, somewhat feline, and quite beautiful. Water was streaming off of her, out of her shorts, out of her long hair, which was plastered to her shoulders. The water made it look inky, but you could still tell that an inch from her scalp, her hair had been stripped of all color by the sun. In Haikou, where the McGregors lived until 4 years ago, Teresa had been a superstar soccer player, but Hana was too small to support a soccer league. So after they moved there, Teresa first devoted herself to becoming something of a juvenile delinquent, and then gave that up for surfing. Her first triumph came right away in 1996, when she won the open women's division at the Maui Hana Mango competition. She was one of the few fortunate amateur surfer girls who had sponsors. She got free boards from Matt Kinoshita, her coach, who owns and designs Kazuma Surfboards, clothes from Hanalua Surf Company, board leashes and bags from Dakine, Hawaii, skateboards from Flex Decks. Boys who surfed got a lot more for free. Even a little bit of sponsorship made the difference between surfing and not surfing. As rich a life as it seemed, among the bougainvillea and the green hills and the passion flowers of Hana, there was hardly any money. In the past few years, the Hawaiian economy has sagged terribly, and Hana had never had much of an economy to begin with. Last year, the surfer moms in town held a fundraiser bake sale to send Teresa and two Hana boys to the National Surfing Competition in California.
Susan Orlean, reading from her The Maui Surfer Girls, later Blue Crush on the big screen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There was a sports car on the road.
On the road.
I thought I knew the fella that drove.
That little sports car was the Prius, an oyster.
Following it was like riding on a roller coaster. Roller coaster. Around the corners and
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Susan Orlean, author of The Orchid Thief, New Yorker writer, portraitist extraordinaire of all kinds of subjects right across the board. She's been generously reading for us tonight, and we've been sitting back and really enjoying it. But I want to go after that question a little bit more about you must have asked yourself, why is it that the subjects I have profiled have drawn these extra levels of attention? Why Hollywood? Why the desire for the popular media to come back and have another scoop? Is it just because Susan Orlean writes them up so doggone well, or have you got an eye for a particular dynamic or a particular kind of person, subject, do you think?
I think some of it is that people like something that's refreshing. There is, and certainly in Hollywood, there is an incredible desire for something new, something that we haven't heard 1,000 times over and over again. If you have a way of presenting those new ideas or new subjects that isn't scary, I mean, Hollywood doesn't like anything that seems too new or too out there. But that sort of excitement of, boy, no one ever thought of doing a movie about girl surfers. It's almost this kind of exhilaration of, oh, here there are new things to look at in the world. And
do
that,
you find the Hollywood piece coming into your consideration of what to write about? Does it leave you looking
goodness.
For iconic figures or, you know, oh, that would have lots of, you know, pretty girls on the beach? Or
I think, thank goodness I don't, because that is a slippery slope. I think if you start writing with movies in mind, first of all, anything I've ever written that in the back of my mind I thought, oh, I bet this will make a great movie, didn't get optioned. It's almost a guarantee,
right,
I think.
You've got to come with purer motive than that.
Yeah, and I think also you've got to, the purity is, you know, to be zen about it. I think you do the stories that really move you, that resonate, you care about them, you desperately want to have readers learn about something new. Maybe it's just the energy that I bring to it infects Hollywood's interest in my work, that it's this feeling of enthusiasm for the world around me that's very real and very genuine. And that's
and
really
got
the
an
only
appetite
way I can
for it
work.
That doesn't go away.
Yeah.
I wonder what you thought of the story that's been in the news just recently, having spent all this time with the Maui surfer girls, of the girl whose arm was taken by a shark. You must have looked at that and thought, oh, my gosh, that could have been any of these girls.
Oh, yeah. It's a real horror story. And she's very lucky, from what I understand. She was very nearly killed. And
now we've seen her back out surfing again.
I know. It's pretty amazing. I mean, these girls are very strong and very they're really tough in the best sense. Look, nobody losing an arm wouldn't be devastated, but those girls kept urging me to come out and go surfing with them. And my issue was I did not want to appear in front of them in a bathing suit. But more than that, I thought, look, you kids grew up in the ocean.
Right.
I'm from Ohio.
That's your place.
I don't want to go out there. No,
I'll watch.
My place
is with the notebook and the typewriter.
Yeah, I sit on the beach. You guys go out there on the waves. So it's not participatory journalism. Believe me, I'm not George Plimpton.
We're going to get you to sing for your supper yeah. just a little more here, if you would. I'd love it if you'd read a bit from this provocatively titled The Bullfighter Checks for Makeup. Could you read just a bit from that?
Certainly. And this was a really wonderful undertaking. I was asked to profile Christina Sanchez, the she's now retired from bullfighting, but she was at the time the premier female matador in Spain. I had seen the first bullfight of my life a few days earlier on that night in Madrid, and it was a profound education. I learned that I should not eat for several hours beforehand and to start looking away the minute the picadors ride in on their stoic-looking blindfolded horses because their arrival signaled that the blood and torment would begin. At first in Madrid, I had been excited because the Plaza de Toros is so dramatic and beautiful, and also the pageantry that began the corrida was very nice. And when the first bull galloped in, I liked watching it bolt around the ring and chase the matador and his assistants until they retreated behind the small fences around the ring that are there for their protection. The small fences had targets, bullseyes actually, painted on them. The bull would ram into them with his horns, and the fence would rock. The more furious bulls would ram again and again until the matador teased them away with a flourish of his cape. The bulls were homely, with little heads and huge briskets and tapered hips, and they cornered like school buses and sometimes skidded to their knees, but they had fantastic energy and single-mindedness and thick muscles that flickered under their skin and faces that didn't look vicious at all and were interesting to watch. Some of the fight was wonderful, the matador's flourishes with the shocking pink and bright yellow cape, and his elegance with the small triangular red one, the sound of thousands of people gasping when the bull got very close to the cape, the plain thrilling danger of it, and the fascination of watching a bull be slowly hypnotized, the bravery of the picador's horses, which stood stock still as the bull pounded them broadside, the flags along the rim of the ring flashing in the late afternoon light, the resplendence of the matador's suit in that angling light, especially when the matador inched 1 foot forward and squared his hips and arched his back so that he was a bright new moon against a sky of sand with the black cloud of a bull racing by. I love the ancientness and majesty and excitement of it, the way bullfighting could be at once precious and refined, yet absolutely primal and raw. But beyond that, I was lost and nauseous and knew that I didn't understand how so many people, a whole nation of people, weren't shaken by the gore and the idea of watching a ballet that always, absolutely, unfailingly ends with a gradual and deliberate death. I didn't understand it then, and I doubt I ever will.
Susan Orlean, reading from her. The bullfighter checks her makeup. We've only got a minute left. I know you're taking some time off this year. I'm sure you're looking around. Can you imagine yourself ever getting out toward the journalistic end of things? Are we going to see Susan Orlean in Baghdad, in Fallujah one day, or is it...
It's tempting. I had a powerful desire to go to Kosovo at one point, and the New Yorker didn't want to send me because they had other people there already. I don't want to ever feel that what I'm writing about is trivial. But I also feel sometimes this subtle story, the story that illuminates just the way people live and who we are, has as much resonance for me as those more dramatic stories, the stories of war and conflict.
And maybe it's exactly why we keep coming back with so much pleasure to your work. Susan Orlean, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Susan Orlean, author of The Orchid Thief and a whole lot more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Thank you, New Hampshire, for lifting up this campaign and the cause of an America that belongs not to the privileged, not to the few, that belongs to all Americans.
We are having to husband our resources. We have 20 states in 5 or 6 weeks, so we're worried about money and we want to be careful about money, but we're not broke.
What an honor and privilege to be here with you, to be back in the state of my birth, not far from where I was born. I feel very much at home here.
The intelligence service believed that there were WMD. It turns out we were all wrong, probably, in my judgment. And that is most disturbing.
The allegation that I or anyone else lied to this House or deliberately misled the country by falsifying intelligence on weapons of mass destruction is itself the real lie.
Once again, the Palestinians have imposed on us a war of terror which we will have to continue to defend ourselves in front of.
The only relation between this attack is with the practice of terror action from Sharon.
I encourage you and your fellow citizens to work at home and abroad for the growth of international cooperation and solidarity.
There's a week. John Kerry sweeps to victory in New Hampshire, site of the nation's first presidential primary. Howard Dean shakes up his campaign staff after his second-place finish in New Hampshire, firing his campaign manager and announcing that his staffers will go unpaid for 2 weeks. The campaign now heads south and west onto turf of the two third-place finishers in New Hampshire, John Edwards and Wesley Clark. Former chief weapons inspector in Iraq, David Kaye, tells a Senate committee that the pre-war intelligence on Iraq's alleged WMD program was all wrong. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair is exonerated of charges that he deliberately exaggerated the pre-war threat posed by Iraq. A Palestinian policeman blows himself up on a bus in central Jerusalem, killing at least 10. And Pope John Paul II delivers a plea for peace and international cooperation during Vice President Dick Cheney's visit to the Vatican. Jack Beattie, there we are, from snowy New Hampshire to Vatican City.
Yes, and from snowy New Hampshire to, Palmy? I don't know if it's Palmy, but...
Palmy, South anyway. Carolina. I think that's the state symbol.
Yeah, okay, good. And John Kerry is looking for southern votes down there, which is interesting given what he said up here at Dartmouth College last week. Someone asked him, how can the Democrats win with a northern candidate? And said, repeated the Edwards, John Edwards argument, that the Democrats have never won the White House without carrying five southern states. And he replied, he said, well, they almost did it in 2000 without carrying a single southern state. And he pointed to Ohio, which Gore lost by 3 percentage points. And Kerry pointed out more jobs have been lost since Bush became president in Ohio than made the margin of Bush's victory in 2000. And he lost, Gore did, by 1% in New Hampshire. And, of course, that's within that was the Nader vote. If he carried either or both of – certainly both, but either one of those states, he would have won without the South.
There's a way to win the South. Say to hell with it.
Say to hell with it.
I'm not sure that'll be a big seller in the South.
I'm not sure either. And mathematically, it looks possible. But we had Earl Black, the Southern political historian, on our show, and he was saying, boy, yeah, it's possible, but it's tough to give up 160 electoral votes right out of the gate to the other guy and then just compete from there on. Any mistake anyplace else, and you're in trouble. So we're going to hear a lot more about this Southern idea. And, there are five open Democratic seats down there. How is that going to sit with them to have the National Party saying, see you later? It was an impolitic thing to say. It may be tipping off what is the Democratic strategy.
Yeah, and yet it may be the only way to win. Who knows?
It may be the only way to win. I talked to a guy, a friend of mine in Little Rock today. He says, if you listen to talk radio down there, it's not issues. It isn't the Democrats' issues, and the Democrats can't get people back with issues. It's this atmospherics. The Democrats are hippies and the Democrats are for various sexual minorities. They're for, racial minorities. They're just not America's party.
Well, we'll see how that plays out when George Bush really comes onto the campaign trail. Republicans have been very good at driving that wedge in when necessary.
They have, and the South is very solid for Bush today. But, I've been thinking more and more about Bush and his father. You can see his presidency as a kind of debate with his father. You raised taxes, I lowered them. All you did was push Saddam out of Kuwait. I got rid of him and occupied Iraq. You fell out of favor with the religious right. I kept them close to me. You were out of touch with the American people, but I, and then you stop at that, because Bush is getting to sound out of touch himself in New Hampshire. He said, you can tell I'm upbeat and I've got good reason to be. The American people are telling me things are getting better and then better. Well, of course, the polls show by 58-38 or something, voters are more concerned about the economy than anything else.
Of course, what the polls will show in November is ultimately who's out of touch, I guess, with a winning majority. And at this point, that's not completely clear. I mean, that's what it's all about these days with the red and blue divide. Who's in touch? Who's out of touch? Who's got just enough of a touch to get that winning margin?
Yes, and where do you have that touch?
It's going to be a great, amazing year, a defining year in so many ways. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.